Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza, and I just want to remind everybody that we can just not do this. That is an option.
Can we do that? Is it really an option?
Of course it's an option. There's going to be a court ruling by the end of the year, right? Or something?
Which court case are you referring to? There's been a couple.
I know, there's quite a few, aren't they? Which is probably more of a reason to just say no. To just go, nah, it's not worth it, mate. Aaron Banks probably swindled the whole thing. No, so basically there is, the one that I'm thinking of is the ECJ ruling on whether or not you can rescind Article 50.
Oh, right. I think that's widely expected to come back as, yes, you can rescind Article 50.
It is very Obama 2008, yes, we can. that is the impression. But it's not yet set in stone and it hasn't been decided yet. Also, it may come with kind of certain caveats. We don't know whether our deal would still be the same, whether we would revert to the default. And I think that would be important information for us to know before we did decide to just go, nah.
I mean, would it change your particular view if it was the status quo ante, or if it was a closer relationship, which I assume would be the other option?
I'd have to revisit it.
Really?
I'd have to think about it a bit more. Like, one of the reasons why I think you're wrong, Jimmy, is because we had such a good deal as members. Like, we had more opt-outs than any other country. We were kind of like there with influence, second largest country to send MEPs. But we went non, je ne veux pas, je veux exciter. Which isn't French for exit, it's sortir. Never mind. Anyway, GCSE A level French, I did really well. What are we talking about this week, Jimmy?
Well, one of the things we are talking about, unsurprisingly, is Brexit. I think we've missed quite a lot of action since our last podcast for reasons we won't go into.
Jimmy was hungover last week.
Yes.
Couldn't even speak to me. It was really quite embarrassing for him.
I could have spoken to you, but it would have been quite a bad podcast, I think.
I feel like those are the kind of things that we need to give to like patrons and stuff.
Yeah, like, possibly.
Jimmy
yeah.
doing a podcast hungover.
Yeah, I'm sure we can make it happen in the future at some point.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. But yes, there's been loads of Brexit stuff happening. We were very naughty that we, along with, didn't follow all of the other vaguely political podcasts on the internet and do kind of like a Brexit reaction special when everybody kind of rescinded their responsibility. Like Dominic Raab left. What's her name?
Esther McVeigh
left. Is she the pig products lady?
No, you're thinking of Liz Truss.
Right. I mean, they all of the Tory women, they all look the same, don't they?
Just because they're two blonde white women, you've just smushed them together.
That is genuinely the reason why.
That
yes,
is absolutely the reason why that just happened. But yeah,
it's totally okay, Jimmy. My mum is white and blonde, so I'm not being racist. It looks like for a really long time that the European Research Group, the ERG, were going to gather enough letters to challenge Theresa May in a leadership contest. The running joke in all of the other podcasts has been, Jacob Rees-Mogg can't count to 48 because they needed 48 letters to trigger the contest. And it just didn't really work, which is a little bit embarrassing. And has kind of relegated Jacob Rees-Mogg to just like, people just find you entertaining. You don't actually have any power in the Tory party, do you?
He has influence, which isn't bad.
Does he? If he had influence, they'd have gotten rid of. They'd have triggered the Theresa May leadership contest.
Well,
he
has some influence. He doesn't have unlimited influence.
Just not very much.
Just
yeah.
not enough in this.
I mean,
instance.
So they were bragging about how they were really close to 48, and apparently it was closer to 24.
Well, I think your mate Tom, is it Tom Harwood or Tom Harford?
Tom Harwood.
Tom Harwood,
yeah,
was
friend of the podcast. Hi, Tom.
Was he was leaking or receiving leaks from the ERG WhatsApp group around how many letters that they had, which definitely went over 48 at certain points, but clearly somebody was being misinformed.
Yeah, I do kind of rub my hands with glee and schadenfreude with that, I'm not gonna lie. Surprise. But Theresa May did a press conference that I stayed up until 2 a.m here, because I'm in Taiwan at the moment. I stayed up until 2 a.m in order to watch it, and she just, and everybody was like, she's gonna resign, and she just went, guys, you forgot, it's me. Yes, we're in crisis, but nothing has changed. Bye, deuces. And she's still prime minister and intends to continue as if nothing has happened.
Yeah, that was such a cocksease, that press conference, because it happened at it was scheduled for 5. It started at 5:30, so I could have gone home, but I was still in the office watching this press conference and just nothing.
Watching a podium.
Yes. Yeah. That's very, very cheeky from Theresa. That's probably the naughtiest thing she's done now. Naughtier than the Wheatfields
incident. After the Wheatfield. Yeah. Yes.
We should probably save at least some Brexit content for the actual segment, because we're going to discuss two other things. Jazz, what's the second thing that we're going to discuss?
Well, as I said, I'm in Taiwan. Taiwan is a place I love very much. It's like my second home, and I'm very invested in what happens here, probably a little bit too much for my own good. So I happened to be here. It was actually a happy accident when they had their local elections. So it was kind of like their version of the midterms, where the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, they have the presidency at the moment, and basically they did really, really badly in the local elections. But this is the first year that they have a new policy when it comes to referenda, where if a group can gather enough signatures equal to 1.5% of the population, then it goes to a referendum to the wider population. We ended up having gay marriage put on the ballot, not once, not twice, not three times, no, Jimmy, not four times, but there ended up being five separate questions about LGBT rights on the ballot this weekend. And all of them did really badly when it came to LGBT equality. So same-sex marriage was rejected on two fronts. Definition of marriage as between a man and a woman was heavily reinforced by about 3 to 1, and LGBT education in schools was rejected to a similarly high level, and it's very sad. But I would like to just kind of like, in a way that I sometimes do, talk about what happened and why Taiwan is a bit of a shit show.
Okay. It's all very positive by the sounds of things.
Oh yeah, no, I'm going to be really chirpy about the whole thing.
Okay, and speaking of ship shows, we are going to be discussing UKIP as our third topic. UKIP has just hired Tommy Robinson, formerly of the English Defence League, and more recently I'm not actually entirely sure what he's doing, but UKIP has appointed him as an advisor of some sort.
He's just an advisor.
Have they not said more specifically what he's advising them on, or just in general?
No, just in general. Just advise us on how to be a little bit more racist, I guess.
This kind of follows on from earlier in the year when UKIP was joined by, you're going to have to remind me of the names of these people, but it was Sargon of Akkad, who has previously been on this podcast, Carl Benjamin.
Yeah, friend of the podcast, Sargon of Akkad.
Properly stretching that a little bit. And also you're that guy you fancy who works for Alex Jones's InfoWars.
What's his name? He's just the sexy Nazi. I can't remember his name.
His name's Prison Planet on Twitter. I can't actually.
It's like Joseph something.
Joseph something James. Watson, isn't it?
Joseph, sure.
Okay, we'll try to remember his name properly for the actual segment. But anyway, I think we're just going to be sort of throwing around where UKIP is
at the moment. And you forgot the guy with the Nazi dog.
Oh, Count Dankula.
Count Dankula, yeah. Yes.
His real name, I think, is Mark Meechan, although I'm pretty sure it's not pronounced like that. Anyway, so UKIP appears to be bringing in people from the far right and alt-right, variously. Although I know that some of our listeners will think that that won't apply to Count Dankula and Sargon of Akkad. But anyway, we're going to be discussing that in the broad. And also, you wanted to bring up the little spat between Carol Cadwalader and Nigel Farage, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm just really quite enjoying two people that I don't think are particularly good at their jobs butting heads very publicly and embarrassingly in the media.
I mean, it's a rich time for that sort of conflict.
Oh, isn't it just? But yeah, kind of like this. She's done a piece where she's documented her repeated attempts to actually be able to pin him down for some kind of an interview. And she's trying to highlight the fact that he's no longer kind of like the beer swilling kind of like guy down the pub who's like who goes to the golf range every Sunday. He is very much kind of like leaning into the European right wing, even Russian kind of leaning side of politics at the moment. Also, can I like he is still an MEP? Is he not? He's still getting
an
MEP.
Yeah, he still is.
Salary.
Yeah. He's lined up for a pretty big pension as well, I think, when they retire.
It makes me so angry.
Okay.
Anyway.
More on Jez's anger later. I think we're going to play some music and ask you for money and thank the people who are already giving us money.
Yes. Well, I mean, you're used to it now, aren't you? Okay, totally. Bye. On the other side.
Here at The Right Dishonourable, we operate on a donate-if-you-can-be-bothered model. That is to say that the podcast will always be free, but if you want to throw us some money just to keep up with running costs, it's always appreciated. You can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable and you'll find all the details needed to do so. Thanks very much to our current patrons, David Warner, Emerson Sparts, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor.
Jimmy, so is Brexit actually going to happen, do you think?
Ooh, that's... I probably should anticipate this question and come up with a clever, glib answer.
Yeah, a witty answer, shouldn't you?
Yeah, but I'm...
I'm sure it happened in an alternate universe.
I still... You know, ultimately, I still think that the... you know, the British politicians, particularly the front benches of the Labour and the Tory party, have to respect the referendum vote in some capacity. And I view it as generally more likely than the second referendum option. But at this stage, it looks kind. I mean, I don't know, actually. I think
do you not think that they have genuinely tried, but now that Theresa May, she sent a letter out to the a letter to the British people, and I'm like, how tweet? But she sent out this letter and she was just like, this is the only deal that we're gonna get, and it is a good deal, and we're gonna do the deal, blah blah blah, deal. This is the only option on the table other than stay in or drop out completely. People, I feel like everybody pretty much agrees that, unless you're a little bit crazy, that just dropping out without any kind of agreement with the European Union is bloody stupid. Like, insulin runs out.
I don't think that is actually as widely agreed as you seem to think it is. There's certainly, I follow a lot of hard Brexiteers on Twitter.
But none of them are in charge. I think that that's the important thing, right? None of them are going to be in a position where they're going to be able to implement that.
Yes, I agree, but they're in a position where they could foil what Theresa May wants to. Well, some of them are anyway. The MPs, at least, are in a position where they could stop Theresa May doing what she wants to do.
But then is that going to happen now? Because we've just had like Donald Tusk say that the EU27 are now ready to approve Theresa May's deal. We also don't have enough time to be able to actually like go back and negotiate again.
No, we don't. We certainly don't. I don't feel we've kind of outlined what the withdrawal agreement entails for those who haven't been paying attention, or those those who, like me, don't really understand what's happening. So could you do that in the rough?
Theresa May's the main problems that people are seeing with Theresa May's deal are the non kind of Great Britain parts of the UK kind of being indefinitely kept as like part of the European Union in the customs union. So that particularly affects Northern Ireland, and it particularly affects Gibraltar as well.
We have some military bases on Cyprus that will kind of be treated as though they're part of the EU for tax and regulatory purposes.
And because of kind of this attempt to maintain the illusion of the fact that the UK is going to be able to continue to function as a single entity with that kind of a deal, there is this kind of like indefinite linking of the UK to European kind of like standards and institutions, so that places like Northern Ireland, Cyprus, and Gibraltar do not diverge from the rest of the United Kingdom.
Yes.
But the main problem is here that then we become basically Norway. And I remember that Norway was always kind of like, essentially, it was always something that was on the table for a lot of Brexiteers. But the thing is, when it comes to if your ideology for leaving the European Union, as I believe it was for you, Jimmy, was kind of like a question of sovereignty. And a question of who makes the rules over the people who are governed. This completely betrays that side of things, does it not?
Yeah, I think it does, by and large. And I think Fraser Nelson, who's the editor of The Spectator, said that in a lot
of... Lovely guy.
Lovely guy? Is that sarcastic?
Who knows?
Okay, we'll leave that on the table. But he tweeted that a lot of his conversations with, I think it included cabinet ministers, a lot of his conversations with prominent Brexiteers said that they thought that the remaining in the EU was actually better than the deal that Theresa May had put on the table.
Yeah. Dominic Raab has certainly said that publicly. Who is the Brexit secretary who resigned last week after his government's policy on Brexit was made public?
Yes, and I think in terms of the self-government thing or the sovereignty thing, as you put it, it does look bad. But at this stage, it seems to me that the negotiations process has gone so badly that it's the soft Brexit deal that Theresa May has effectively offered is kind of the only game in town. I kind of agree with you that no deal seems potentially so risky and so laden with problems that it's a non-starter, really. But I'd probably support the withdrawal agreement with a view to actually loosening the ties over a longer period.
But then does that, even if it means losing places like Gibraltar and Northern Ireland? Considering the history of those places? Because that's what this leaves the door open to.
Well, I mean, with regards to Gibraltar, it seems kind of crazy that you'd sacrifice, you know, what are broadly the wishes of the rest of the UK just to serve the interests of Gibraltar, particularly given that Gibraltar actually voted to remain within the EU. And therefore,
yeah, by like 96%.
Yeah, I mean, presumably they're not too offended by the idea that they'll actually continue to be within the remit of the EU, you know, albeit in a slightly more associative kind of
membership. Sure, but Gibraltar's Britishness is such a strong part of their identity, is so important to them, and the idea that Spain would then also end up being consulted on Gibraltar issues, I think it's such a betrayal of Gibraltar and the identity of the people that have ended up living there.
I mean, I guess so, but you know,
it's like, it would be like giving the Argentinians joint control over the Falklands. Like, it's a similar level of betrayal.
Yeah, but Gibraltar ultimately has to choose between being closely tied to Spain or, you know, given the way the UK appears to be going, more closely tied to the UK and, you know, more separated from Spain. That, you know, that in the long term seems to be the options that they have.
Yeah, but I think that I keep on using the word betrayal, Jimmy, but I can't really think of anything else because that's all The Guardian has told me to say.
But, I mean, reversing the question then, after the referendum, the Ashcroft polling indicated that sovereignty or self-government, which I think is actually a better reflection of what people wanted, was the main reason people voted to leave the EU. And I think even among Remainers, at least among vaguely sophisticated,
it's a high grievance, right?
Yeah, I mean the whole democratic deficit thing, a general distaste for how the EU functions, I think was actually was very common among Leavers and was actually common among a fair few Remainers who actually understood how the EU works. And isn't it also a betrayal of what people voted for? Not so much in Gibraltar, but in the rest of the UK. For you know, long term, us not to actually be more separate from the EU than this agreement actually appears to set out.
Yeah, no, I agree, but I don't think that that's what was. And I mean, we're going into like kind of like anecdotal evidence here, right? But I don't think that. Where people expected us to be able to have a close relationship with the EU, but to not have to sacrifice any of that stuff. And you can say what you like in terms of how it was. Like there were certain people who said that it would be that this would be the end result is us being kind of like tied in. I mean, it's such an embarrassing end to a country that I really, really love.
Is this the end, Jazza? Is it all over?
I mean, yeah, it's towards the end of the end. To be completely honest, we end up if we go ahead with Theresa May's deal, and this is one of the reasons that I think I have kind of swum back to the idea that my preferences go remain, leave with no deal, and then this deal. Because the idea that we would then end up having to have so much of our country's future decisions decided by an institution that we are no longer democratically involved in, that I think is a huge injustice. And I'm going to continue to use hyperbole to talk about it.
I mean, I do see what you mean, but in the short term, no deal doesn't really seem to be a goer, does it? Because, you know, whatever you think about you know, people's rights to democratic accountability and stuff, people still probably prefer having access to medicine and food over those things.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you would never accuse me of just believing this because I'm a Remainer, Jimmy, but I think that the only real sensible next step is to throw it back to the people, is to throw it back to another referendum. Where those three options are there, because we now know exactly what that deal is that Theresa May has had. It is incredibly unpopular. It is the least popular out of the three options of Remain, Leave, and the deal. Mm. And the fact that we would end up having a result that has, I think, approvals in the low teens.
This is according to polling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The fact that would be end up being the result, I think, is just insane. Is it not?
I don't see how a loser's referendum solves any of those problems. I mean, firstly, I mean, you have the whole question as to what you put on the ballot paper, but let's say that you put all three options.
All three, and then ranking and preference.
Ranking and preference. You know, there's some way you can work out how to do it where it doesn't just become Remain versus. Where Remain doesn't just win by dint of the fact that the Leave vote is split. Even when you finish that that poll, if Remain wins by not very much, let's say 55-45 ultimately, that is just not going to have any legitimacy. It's going to look very much like what happened is that people voted against the preferences of established politicians. The politicians went and bungled the negotiation process.
But if they bungled the negotiation process, then of course that we should be able to not take what it is that the politicians bungled. And I don't buy that anybody deliberately bungled it. I just think that they weren't good enough to be able to put on the table and to offer us what they actually promised and what was expected.
Well,
I think it is okay for us to then go, bugger that, we're not going to let you decide what the future of the country is. We're going to take it back.
But it won't be seen as the people taking it back. It will be seen with, frankly, some justification as a small group of Remainers having hijacked the entire process and then, you know, gone back to the country on a second referendum And then, but my point is, even if the Remain wins ultimately, and even if, you know, in objective terms, that is actually quite a sensible decision, the look of the thing is very, very bad.
How would have the look of the thing? I don't think necessarily has to be bad. It's only bad if you approach it like that.
It doesn't matter how you approach it. It matters how it will look generally, and it will look generally very bad. It will look like a case of European democracy where there's a vote that takes place in relation to the EU. The people give a result that the EU doesn't like, and so they call another vote later to get the result they want. Ireland's previous reference.
I think this is really different to Ireland, where there wasn't an attempt to renegotiate the Lisbon Treaty. There wasn't an attempt to change things. They just asked again. But there's been 2 years of very deliberate attempts to try and get some kind of a deal that doesn't screw up the UK. And if this is the best deal that the leading party can come up with, and it has such low approval ratings, I think that then it should be decided by the people whether or not we finally shoot ourselves in the foot. What we should have done, what we should have actually ended up doing, is after we had voted and we'd triggered Article 50, there should have been a cross-party consensus as to how to proceed with leaving the European Union. This should have been across every single party, so that there was as close to a national consensus as possible. But it wasn't. This is a conservative Brexit with a party that doesn't even have a majority in the Houses of Parliament. And I think that the only way to be able to get any kind of like a legitimacy back is for there to be a public vote on it.
Well, I don't think the vote will gain that legitimacy, because I don't think there's any way it can look legitimate. And it doesn't matter. Some of what you said does make sense, by the way. I'm not really arguing with some of your logic. It's just that it won't look that
way.
I always
get chills, Jimmy, whenever you say I'm sometimes right.
I mean, in many ways you are right, but it won't look that way because people will not think about it in the terms that you've just laid out. It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter.
Who are these people you're thinking of?
Just the average voter. The average voter has not followed these processes very closely. They do not have a sophisticated...
But then the average voter will be the person who's ended up voting for whatever the result is. So it would have been the voter's decision.
I mean, yeah, ultimately...
If the average voter sees it as, like, chucking it back, then they can vote to just leave again.
Yeah, but in the breach, people are probably just going to vote with what they want. But that doesn't mean that this isn't going to cause an immense amount of distrust in democracy going forward, with some justification.
Yeah, I'm not sure trust in democracy is going particularly well in the West anyway, Jimmy, let's be fair.
It isn't, but this is not going to help it, you know. I mean, that's like saying, oh, I'm very ill, so I'm just going to eat some of this mouldy cheese because I'm already ill, and therefore it doesn't matter if I make myself slightly more ill. You know, that's just illogical.
But that's how I feel about this Brexit deal. No.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, your own feelings about this process are different from how, you know, this will be perceived more widely is what I'm getting at.
I don't know. I'm not sure that you have your finger on the pulse of Sally from Kent. I don't know. I just made her up. Do you think that this could have gone any better, that a better deal would have been possible?
Yes, because I think ultimately the thing you said about like a cross-party consensus, I sort of agree with. I think it should have after the vote we should have held a citizens' jury in the same manner to which the Irish held a citizens' jury before their vote on the abortion rights, so that they could actually come to some sort of sensible consensus, and you know that whole process grants its own kind of legitimacy, I think. And we should have gone down that route and then negotiated over a longer time period. I think the whole the way Article 50 works is not in the interest of the country that's leaving. And I think at the very least we could have prepared much much better before triggering Article 50, which would effectively have given us more negotiating time. Mm-hmm. And obviously the decision to call a general election after Article 50 was triggered was disastrous. There's been a lot of very poor strategic decisions on the part of basically Theresa May in relation to all of this. And you know, if you'd had some sort of consultative process after the referendum, and then prepared properly before triggering Article 50 and not held a general election, then yeah, ultimately I think we would have ended up with a slightly better deal out of this whole thing.
Yeah, unfortunately not what happened, is it? Do you think that Theresa May will be around for very much longer? People are suggesting that the actual challenge to her leadership will happen when the bill goes through Parliament.
I'm kind of sceptical because I think the fundamentals that have kept her in place, that there's ultimately no better candidate for leading the party at this point, which is why she has survived all previous crises up until this point, are still the same. There still is no better candidate. And that, you know, the fact that she is weak in many respects doesn't really change that, because, you know, it's the old canard about how do you outrun a polar bear? You run faster than your friend. And then, you know, that's ultimately what she's doing at this point.
Oh, God, who's the polar bear?
Probably the EU in this scenario. Or
a massive blue starry polar bear.
I don't know. I think I've lost track of this metaphor, but yeah. I think her position's better than a lot of people think, and I actually think it was even it would even be surprisingly strong if the ERG had managed to get 48 letters and mount a challenge against her, because
yeah, I think she would have perhaps won that.
Yeah, I think it's very possible. I mean, those sort of situations can be chaotic, so you can't say with certainty, but I think, you know, there's no one that looks like they're going to be able to beat her in a leadership contest.
Jacob Rees-Mogg seems to continue to think that it's going to be Boris Johnson who should take over from her.
He's very popular among normal Tory party members. He's not popular among MPs. Yeah, I think there was some polling recently I was looking at.
How terrifying. Well, we will continue to obviously be the experts that we are on the whole Brexit process, dear listener, and continue to talk about it nowhere near as frequently as you want us to.
Do you think they want us to talk about it more? There's not an awful lot to say, really, a lot of the time. It's just the same old arguments with slightly different technical details.
Be quiet, Jimmy, because that has been the format of the podcast for 120 episodes.
Yes, that's true.
It's just the same argument again and again and again, but with slightly more banter.
That's true.
The banter has gotten better.
There's no way to neatly transition into the Taiwanese gay marriage debate, so we're just going to change topic now. Jasmine, what's happening about Taiwanese gay marriage?
Oh dear. So in 2016, Taiwan elected its first lady president. It was very exciting. Her name is Tsai Ing-wen. She did a doctorate at London School of Economics. Oh, she's one of us, Jimmy.
We won't hold that against her.
She came to power on riding kind of like on a wave after the Sunflower Revolution, which was a pro-democracy, anti-mainland Chinese movement led mainly by young Taiwanese students who kind of fixed themselves to her party's kind of like coalition and then swept her to power. And they did really, really well in the parliamentary and the presidential elections in 2016. Since then, Tsai has become less and less popular. She's seen as quite indecisive when it comes to the legislation that she tries to put through, and rather dithering. One of the things that her government has managed to do is to introduce a new law where if you're able to get 1.5% of the population to sign a petition, it will then be put to the question on the petition will then be put to the wider population in a referendum.
There's a similar law in California, right?
Yeah, and a similar law in Switzerland as well. And obviously, this is where, California is an interesting example because that's where Prop 8 happened. And Proposition 8 was obviously overturned the rights of same-sex couples to get married in 2008. Basically, last year, Taiwan actually legislated that there was a court ruling that said that the country had to, within 2 years, had to have some kind of equal status for same-sex couples. I think they used the word marriage, but it was kind of seen as a massive victory, and Taiwan was going to be the first place in Asia, in the whole of Asia, to have gay marriage. Tsai Ing-wen, because of her base being not the students that arguably brought her into power, but kind of like the working classes and social conservatives of like the South, if you think of like the American Rust Belt or the UK's like industrial North, those are kind of like the DPP's, her party's base. Because gay marriage wasn't very popular among her party's base, she was just like, oh, I don't know what to do. And anti-LGBT groups saw an opportunity. So the Christians in the country are only about 4% of the population, but they managed to build a coalition based around traditional family values and traditional Confucian values, which tend to be very kind of like familiar, hierarchical, mum and dad and child and grandparents and stuff. Everyone has a very specific gendered and age-defined role. And with some help from actually the guys who were behind the victory of Prop 8 in 2008, who were like some renter homophobe from America,
came. It's a hell of a service.
It is. They're actually very good at what they're doing. He came over to kind of like help the campaign. And there's been a lot of really quite nasty stuff circulating, not on like official sites, but in closed networks like online and on like WeChat and places like that, which are similar to like services like WhatsApp. So it's quite hard to regulate what kind of official and correct information people are getting told. So a lot of target demographics who ended up voting against equal marriage had seen videos saying that Taiwan was going to end up turning into an AIDS island.
which is
obviously, yeah, no, they weren't subtle.
That's very, and unfortunately, very on the nose.
Yeah, very on the nose. Unfortunately, the vote was yesterday, and it went really, really badly. Not only for the ruling DPP, who have been unpopular for various other reasons, not least because relations with China have been bad, and so the economy hasn't been going so well. Because the DPP are also broadly pro independence. But the ballot measures on the ballot for LGBT rights, including gay marriage and LGBT education in primary and secondary schools, were both overwhelmingly rejected by the electorate. So Taiwan at the moment has this weird kind of like thing where the population, the plebiscite, have said, we don't want gay marriage, but the court ruling of the High Court have ruled the opposite. And so it looks like there's going to be some kind of like a civil partnership compromise.
Wait, was gay marriage legal before this referendum took place?
No, there was a necessity for it to become legal within 2 years of that court ruling from last year. But Tsai Ing-wen took her bloody time, didn't she? And the conservative groups ended up exploiting this new law on referenda.
I mean, presumably, if the relevant legislation had been passed to make gay marriage legal, that legislation would have been voided or would have needed to be voided at some point in the future following this referendum result.
It would have been. This is the thing. Nobody really knows what takes precedent and what is more. What has more legitimacy here, which is why, because this is the first time that this kind of a thing where the legal process has been counteracted by like a plebiscite. And so how this gets dealt with by the DPP in the next few months is going to be really, really critical in kind of like what takes precedent. Isn't the law, is it the courts, or is it these referendums? Because 1.5% of the population is not a huge amount of signatures to get, especially in the digital age. It's something like 300,000 to 400,000 votes, signatures they would need to get, and plenty of issues get more signatures than that in the UK.
I mean, occasionally someone in the UK will start a politician to say, make Jeremy Clarkson Prime Minister or something like that, and it will gain a couple of 100,000 signatures.
Yeah, and imagine if every time that we ended up doing that, we'd end up having to, like, vote on it.
Yeah, that would be pretty crazy. I mean, I wanted
to ask you about this, because you love a little bit of democracy.
I do enjoy a bit of democracy, it's true.
Love a bit of democracy, partaking and criticising. Do you think that... what do you think of these kind of like direct democracy measures that I think are less popular now in the West, but they were certainly talked about an awful lot more pre-Trump and pre-Brexit when we still believed that democracy worked? Taiwan is still kind of like in that almost naive kind of like dipping its feet into digital democracy, into more open democracy, and this kind of opening up of the ability of people being able to put measures on the ballot paper is kind of like the biggest attempt to be able to do that. But do you think that there are flaws in that kind of legislation?
It sort of touches on something that is very obvious when you think about it, but appears not to ever really be discussed publicly, which is that democracy and human rights can often come into conflict where a majority of people don't want to give a given minority, you know, in this case, gay people, the right to do something, in this case, get married. And I don't think it's something that has ever been satisfactorily resolved. It's a tension that seems to hang in the air across most of the West as far as these kind of policies go. I mean, the classic example in the UK is the death penalty, which was they stopped using it in the UK before it was abolished by MPs in a vote. So it was sort of wound down by the courts and then by the legislature, and yet it has remained. I think even to this day there's a majority of people that would be in favour of the death penalty being used in, say, terrorist cases. Mm-hmm, or you know, being there as an option in terrorist cases.
I mean, just having it like it doesn't really matter what the case is, but they would be happy for there to be a death penalty.
Yeah, but yeah, basically, and for certain crimes. And I don't, you know, relatively speaking, I don't think the UK is a particularly reactionary country, so that it's quite striking.
Isn't it now? It's 2018, Jimmy. Are we not?
Relatively, no, I don't think we are. You know, I think, you know, just looking up Pew survey results about social attitudes in pretty much any country in the world will quickly illustrate that to you. I know the last couple of years have been difficult for you with all the voting, but that still remains true.
It has been very hard for me. Thank you for acknowledging that. That means a lot.
Yeah, I guess, on a personal level, I think that gay people should be able to get married, but on another level, I'm going to avoid answering this question properly and just throw it back to you.
That's very unlike you, isn't it?
If a majority of people think that gay people should not be allowed to get married, why should the views of a minority take precedence over that?
I just want to be able to get married, you know? Yeah. And it objectively doesn't hurt anybody. It's not doing anything wrong. It doesn't affect somebody else's life. And I think it's very hard to argue with the idea that direct democracy and more democracy is a good thing. And that people voting on how they are governed, I want more engagement and I want more of those kinds of decisions to be made by people. But also, how can we end up protecting and like buoying up the rights of minorities, because we end up getting fucked over, because there end up being it's not just fear mongering, but because the lots of straight people would probably never met a gay person or a trans person or a person of color, and so they don't know what the example is and what our actual experience is, what kind of people we are, and they just end up seeing. If there were a perfect world where everybody were able to kind of like understand, know, and to know a spread of like people from lots of different minorities, London, for example, an incredibly diverse city, there would be more acceptance. But the fact is, when you're a minority, you aren't everywhere, and you can't be there representing your people, and it just falls to what either the media says about you or how you are represented in the media, and that so often falls short in like nationwide discourse.
You're sort of arguing from the view that people, if they just knew more, or they, you know, if they had more direct experience of these things, then they would see things more your way. But the data shows that
if you know immigrants, then you're less likely to be anti-immigration. If you know queer people, then you're less likely to be anti-LGBT rights. Like that's
also shows that in more diverse places there's less social trust. Okay, there's a social science word for it that is escaping me at this point, but yeah, I mean the data are not actually fully aligned in those cases, and you also have the question.
But then you're measuring different things there. Like, how are you measuring trust? What is the question that gets asked there? What does that actually end up measuring?
I don't know, Jazz. I haven't read the papers. I just
blooming paper before you throw a stat at me. I've got a master's degree now, Jimmy. You got to be careful.
I'm no respecter of credentials. You know me. I don't think it is necessarily obvious that you know, the more people know, the more that they necessarily turn into these you know, tolerant global citizens that you're pushing forward. And you know, even if that were the case,
that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying they all of a sudden become like hippy dippy loopy toopies, but I'm saying that they are able to empathize with these people that they've actually met.
Yeah, but I mean, there's probably quite.
I'm not
a lot.
Saying they're all going to start going to coffee shops and like ordering mocha chocolates.
But even so, there are probably quite a lot. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people who have a gay friend that they know and like, but are still opposed to gay marriage or something similar.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Sure, but if you know a gay person, then you are less likely to not support gay marriage.
But might it be the case that you're more likely to know a gay person,
and of course
if you're already running in those more progressive circles?
Yeah, but I think I think there's a bit of give and take there.
I guess I'm asking, is the chain of causation established, or is this just a correlative thing at this point?
I would argue that there is a chain of, like, once you meet somebody, then it becomes, although of course there is a, I mean, it goes both ways, doesn't it? And who am I to say? I don't know. I've not done the survey. But I would argue that based on kind of like my theory here, that is one of the main reasons that Taiwan has ended up voting this way. Taiwan is actually seen in Asia as the most progressive. It tops like all of kind of like the Asia-wide indices that suggest that it is the most friendly towards LGBT rights and LGBT people when it comes to legislation, when it comes to rights, when it comes to how you're treated in the street, safety, all of those kinds of things. It has the largest gay pride parade in Asia, like hundreds of thousands of people descend on Taipei every year. But what part of the problem is that it is very concentrated in the urban centres, especially in Taipei, and there isn't a huge amount of mixing of queer people being in the poorer, more working class parts of the country. People tend to, if you're born in like Kaohsiung in the south, which tends to be more working class, and you're a queer person, you're more likely to then take your life up to Taipei and just live there, and you're not integrated into the society that ended up voting very much against the rights of LGBT people this weekend.
Yeah, I mean that all does make sense, but do you see that process changing though, or do you think that that's just a structural problem now that we're gonna have for a while?
Well, I think it takes time, and I think that actually this was we've discussed this before, that the way that Labour brought in civil partnerships rather than gay marriage, and it made me, and I think that you've praised it in the past because it was kind of like incremental. There wasn't a majority in kind of like the public consciousness for gay marriage, and so they brought in civil partnerships as like an everything but. And then 7 or 8 years later, we ended up with equal marriage, and it already had public consensus because people had seen that, oh yeah, gay people living together and loving each other isn't going to make my marriage any less, you know, valid. I think it's part of the thing. There was more visibility, and it like became more of an accepted thing. And perhaps Taiwan was trying to do too much too soon. Maybe it went too, it ran before it could walk. And this is kind of like a backlash against that socially progressive kind of like leaning that it has had in certainly the past 10 years. There have been attempts on the islands to have gay marriage before. Like they even proposed gay marriage before the UK did in 2005. It was initially voted down, but they will continue to do that. And they will continue to kind of like fight for this. And there will be progress in the next 3 months when it comes to LGBT rights because of this court ruling. There will probably be something like civil partnerships.
Is that kind of a betrayal of the vote that's just taken place, though, especially given how overwhelmingly gay marriage was rejected?
So gay marriage was rejected, but then the homophobes were nice enough. One of the questions on gay marriage, there ended up being three. It was a nightmare. But one of the questions was, if there is support of, if there ends up being a recognition of same-sex couples, then it will not affect the current definition of marriage, which now, because of the referendum, is going to be between a man and a woman. So it doesn't stop there being options for the recognition of same-sex couples, rather than the whole thing was around marriage, using the word marriage. And so there is still a gap for there to be a non-marriage option. And that's still a step forward for Taiwan. And we can't ignore that.
Yeah, I suppose the thing you said about Tony Blair's civil partnerships program probably is the answer to that inherent conflict between, you know, a hard liberal agenda on human rights and all that sort of thing, and actually bringing the public along, as it were, is that it has to be done. You know, this is sort of unsatisfying for people that think, well, you know, this doesn't affect anyone else, so why am I not allowed to do it? But, you know, ultimately you do have to bring people with you on these sorts of things.
Yeah, I do kind of, but then it would have been, I'm not sure how it's worked with kind of like other, especially more some of the earlier recognitions of same-sex couples with marriage. But it would have been interesting to see what then happened if, I mean, there's a country, Taiwan is now a place that where 75% of people don't think that gay people should get married. It would have been interesting to see if the legislation had beaten the referendum to the gun, whether or not the public opinion would have then gone along with the legislation. That would have certainly been an interesting thing to see, but we won't find that out now. We're going to have to wait a little bit longer.
Well, it's one of the inherent flaws with referendums is that depending on how you phrase
it,
depending on how you phrase the question, you can get very different answers for what is ultimately the same proposition.
That's one of the reasons why there were five questions, was because it was the same question phrased differently.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
They'd come back with wildly different results? I mean, then the referendum would have basically been useless.
Yeah, I know. Almost like Brexit. Speaking of Brexit, UKIP.
Yes, that was almost. I think that was a good segue.
It was the best I could do. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So as we said at the introduction, Tommy Robinson, formerly of the English Defence League, which was a far-right marching group. I don't know how long it's been since.
A far-right marching group? That just sounds like they go out with like drums and a trumpet and like twiddle some batons.
Well, what else would you describe them as, since they didn't really do anything other than march?
They march and they were like a violent violent gang. A march group is too sweet.
Were they a violent gang? I think all they did was turn up and bother people.
Yeah! That's pretty bloody violent, isn't it?
Okay. A violent...
It's like calling the IRA dancers.
A violent far-right marching gang. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually going to look it up, but how Wikipedia describes them. But go on.
I hope that I hope that they did actually punch people. Now that we've made that allegation on the podcast.
Oh, they've definitely punched people. Okay. The English Defence League is a far right Islamophobic organisation. Let's just go with organisation.
Organisation. That's so vague though. That doesn't help people.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to Wikipedia.
Okay. Anyway, so Tommy Robinson, who left the English Defence League a while back, has now been appointed as an advisor to UKIP by its current leader, Gerard Batten, who I don't actually know anything about Gerard Batten, but he took over after the various Nigel Farage replacements, you know, failed to last more than like a month or two. I think one lasted less than 14 days in one instance.
Yeah, she did. The first one, the lady. Yeah. I can't remember her name.
Diane something? Does that sound right?
She had nice hair.
She had nice hair. I mean, Tommy Robinson's appointment has been so controversial that even Nigel Farage has actually criticised Gerard Batten for it.
When Nigel Farage is going, oh, maybe not. And maybe you need to settle down a little bit.
It's kind of like being told to sober up by Pete Doherty, or something.
Oh, wait.
Or Keith Richards, maybe, if we have any older listeners.
We don't.
You don't know that. Podcasting data is very sketchy.
It is, yeah.
What do you think about UKIP these days, Jazz? Is this just the final winding down of the party into a far right group, you know, irrelevant group, basically, from their heights just before the Brexit referendum?
Well, there's certainly an attempt for them to kind of recalibrate as an alt-righty kind of movement, because of the not least because of the inclusion of like Sargon of Akkad, Count Dankula. I hope that's his official name on his UKIP membership card, by the way. And Paul Joseph Watson, the sexy Nazi. They're certainly trying to tap into that kind of like low middle class, working class, white resentment. But I don't think it's really there beyond kind of like chat rooms. And I don't think it's really there. I don't think it is a viable kind of like election force, really, in the UK, not least because of the one of the problems that UKIP used to have quite a lot, wasn't it? Like they never had enough votes in an individual constituency, and so they never had more than two MPs. Mm.
Were defections rather than being outright
rather
elected.
Than winning. Yeah, exactly.
Although I think Douglas Carswell, after he changed, had a by-election, didn't he?
You are correct. Yeah, he was voted in.
Yeah.
I see it as an attempt. I'm not sure it's particularly good. I'm not sure who is going to sign up to UKIP now that Johnny Robinson is a blooming member.
Tommy Robinson. But,
sorry, Johnny. Yeah,
Johnny. Just pick another generic English name.
I mean, you know, right? What's your analysis? What do you think?
I think that it's almost I hesitate to describe it in these terms, but it's also almost like a market repositioning in that.
Oh my god!
Obviously, Theresa May's, you know, the Tories by and large have embraced Brexit, so that takes away a major reason for voting UKIP, and
so the only base that they have left is racism.
I don't want to put it that straightforwardly, but. Yeah,
don't worry.
I mean, you already have done, but you know, if UKIP are to, you know, get any votes at all, then they need to distinguish themselves from the Tories. And previously, because of the Tory position on the EU, that was easy to do. But now, because Theresa May is also, I think, has a bit more of a socially conservative vibe than David Cameron did. So actually a lot of the reasons why people were voting UKIP have disappeared. And this is almost like a company has started to fail, so they've appointed a radical CEO to try out some new ideas just to see if it will stay alive. And I'm not sure it will do, to be honest. I think Tommy Robinson's actually less of a significant appointment than Gerard Batten consulting with Paul Joseph Watson and that kind of crowd.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But are they consulting? They're just kind of really members, and they made it very clear that they had no intention of actually kind of like running for anything in the party, didn't they?
No, they did You're right that they did say, well, you know, we're not going to stand for election under UKIP, we've just become members. But they, a couple of them were brought in because there were photographs of them in a meeting with Gerard Batten, and they were apparently discussing things like digital strategy and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Gerard Batten just sounds like a lord, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. Lord Batten.
Do you think that we should be concerned about the them being kind of like included in digital strategy? And them not being scared to kind of use far-right tactics and like alt-right tactics, because they've certainly worked in the past.
I think we should probably dispute slightly the extent to which you can describe them as alt-right tactics. So Paul Joseph Watson, I think that's sort of fair enough. But it's worth saying Carl Benjamin, or Sargon of Akkad as his online name is, describes himself as a classical liberal.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can describe myself as a bloody unicorn. Doesn't mean I actually have a horn in the middle of my head, does it?
Well, some of his politics are from that side of things. I mean, it's also worth saying when we spoke to him...
Yeah, and I also glitter and have hooves. I'm still not a unicorn.
Some of his politics are more of that bent. Although some of them are more, I would say, social democratic in the sense that he still supports things like the NHS and all of that stuff. So their politics are kind of weird, and they're kind of actually hard to make out very clearly. And I think that it's maybe intentional. You know, some of the playing with the Pepe the Frog alt-right imagery, it seems to be semi-ironic, but it's kind of hard to tell, you know, the extent to which they're being ironic and the extent to which they're not being ironic, which is, you know...
I think if you land on the political spectrum where they land and you use Pepe the Frog, you're not... I don't think you're able to use him ironically, are you?
I don't know, because it depends who's watching you. I mean, the thing that they would say is that, you know, the audience gets that it's a joke, and it's just because some writer from the New Statesman or the Guardian comes along and says, oh no, this is far right, and, you know, misses out on, it, you know, almost a context collapse idea, really.
Oh my God, look at you using social science terms.
Just because you dropped it on me a fortnight ago.
Yeah.
But I think that's sort of fair in some ways. I think that there is kind of something going on that mainstream journalists maybe struggle to understand. It's a fairly common thing when you're reading any mainstream journalist discuss a topic that you're very familiar with to notice that they get things wrong and that they misunderstand things, and that's just a general flaw with mainstream journalism, I think. Where were we going with this? Yeah, I don't really see what advantage is going to be gained by hiring Tommy Robinson, given how divisive that he is as a figure.
How much of it do you think is that it was just an attempt for us to talk about UKIP again?
Do we think that Gerard Batten's that smart? What do you reckon?
I don't know. I literally have no idea who the guy is.
I stopped
paying attention after they had their like third member, their third leader.
Member. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think the party's in a death spiral, and this is kind of... It will be interesting to see how the Brexit process finishes and what effect that has on UKIP, but for the time being, I think they're done, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a shame. They also now have a logo that looks like the Premier League's lion, which is was very annoying to the Premier League. Shall we wrap up?
Do you want to discuss Nigel Farage and Carol Cadwalader just before we finish?
Oh, yeah, sure. Carol Cadwalader is a... I don't think she's very good at her job at the moment, but like, that's fine. I think that this is actually like this kind of like what she's kind of like documenting with Nigel Farage as kind of like somebody who doesn't want to talk to press, who only really partakes in political set pieces, and is now kind of like integrated into quite a lot of far right politics, shifting away from kind of like Jack the Lad down the pub with his pint and a fag and all that kind of stuff. I think that's an interesting thing to pay attention to, and I wouldn't want to patronise Carol Cadwalader by saying, well done, you noticed a thing. But she noticed a thing. And I think that perhaps paying attention to that would be a good thing for the media to do going forward. I don't think he's given nearly as much of a platform as he used to, because obviously he's now just an MEP who's going to get a really, really nice pension, as you said.
He still has, I think it's a weekly radio show with LBC.
LBC, yeah.
Yeah.
Where you can call in. I haven't tried yet. Shall we do it 1 week?
No, I'm really not interested.
No?
Sorry.
You want no fun?
I think LBC's format is just terrible, really. It largely consists... I mean, the call-in show, at least. Those are the only ones I've listened to. But it largely consists of idiots who don't know anything calling into radio presenters who do know something, and then, you know, the inevitable occurs, really.
We'd fit into that format beautifully.
I mean, where do we sit in that format, though? Because we know some things, but...
Isn't that all that... I'll let the listeners decide where we fall in on that spectrum.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that... I don't know if you were referencing this deliberately or not, but Carol Cadwalader phoned in to Nigel Farage's show.
Yes.
And she, under a fake name, when she got live... she said, "Oh, I'm Carol Cadwalader. I have a couple of questions to ask you." And Nigel Farage quickly cut the call off. I'm interested in this, because you said that you don't think she's very good at her job. So what exactly do you mean by that? Because she's obviously done all this stuff around Cambridge Analytica and...
And I think that she keeps on grasping at the wrong straws of Cambridge Analytica as if Facebook are the bloody evil ones. And I think that that is the wrong... She has approached a lot of these stories with the assumption of there being guilt rather than the other way around. And I think that has actually damaged quite a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the arguments around there being kind of like Russian collusion and misuse of ads and stuff. A lot of her Cambridge Analytica coverage specifically is the stuff that I have the biggest problem with. Basically, you can come away with her... you can come away from her reporting with the conclusion that all targeted advertising is bad, which I think is so myopic and stupid, and doesn't understand how advertising has ever worked. And it was like deliberately sensationalist, and I don't think it. That's why I don't think she's particularly good at her job, mainly because of Cambridge Analytica. I'm sure she's done other great stuff, like this Farage stuff.
I mean, I don't know if you read the article, but there was a piece, I think it was this weekend, where she said she recorded her attempts to track down Nigel Farage at various events and approach him through various channels. And it reminded me a little bit of that Louis Theroux documentary where he tries to interview Michael Jackson and never quite gets round to interviewing him. And it's, I mean, that's actually quite a good documentary, but... It is a little bit like, oh, I tried to ask this person questions and he didn't want to speak to me, which, you know, as a journalist, that doesn't mean that there's incredible wrongdoing going on here. It just means that they might not be interested in speaking to you.
Perhaps.
You know.
But also, it is Nigel Farage.
He's a shady guy. No one's disputing that. Mm-hmm. But as you say, like, if you follow Cadwalader on Twitter, she often just tweets out vignettes which grasping at not very much, really, and just saying like, oh, this is true and this is true. Could there be a link between them? And it's like, it's fine to raise those hypotheses, you know, in your own mind and then try and investigate them, but just going online and randomly like tweeting them out when you've no real backing for them is quite another thing, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, should we finish slagging her off and wrap up the podcast then?
I didn't really actually want it to turn into a Carol Cadwalader kind of like bashing match, but yes, let's wrap it up. Sorry, Carol. Fan, I'm sure you're a fan of the podcast. I think you're great. So you can follow us at Right Dishonor on Twitter. The podcast is occasionally sentient. I am at Jazza Johnna. Jimmy is at JDE Nichols. Jimmy, what else should they do if they like us?
They can go to patreon.com/rightdishonorable and sign up to send us money every episode.
Also, review us on iTunes.
Yes.
Because apparently iTunes is still a place where people do their podcasts.
And people can find us on Acast, can't they? That's also a thing.
Yeah, but don't, because somebody's getting money for that, and it's not us. you can listen to us on Spotify if you'd rather listen to us there. We actually are there, and it's legit.
It's legit, yeah. We approached, or Jazza approached Acast and asked if they'd be interested in hosting us a while back, and they said no. Did they say no directly, or did they just ignore you?
Yeah, they did. They did say no.
They said no.
And then I asked for clarification, and then they ignored me. but we're still, for some reason, on their website, and I don't understand really how that's happened.
Yeah.
But you know what? We're raking in the view. We're not raking any.
It's probably some sort.
We're not raking anything.
It's some sort of Cambridge Analytica related conspiracy, I'm sure.
Obviously. Right, yes. Okay, let's finish this now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.